Hello and welcome to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. Today on Line One, we will be discussing long-term acute care and rehabilitation in Alaska. When someone has a critical illness, such as a stroke or a heart attack, or a major injury, such as a spinal cord injury or traumatic brain injury, they often need long-term care and intensive rehabilitation. This allows patients to receive long-term care as an intermediate step between traditional hospital inpatient care and going home. Due to lack of services in Alaska, this kind of care has often required patients in Alaska to travel out of state, which, for the patient, the family, and the support system, is exceptionally challenging. Yet, thankfully, that is changing. Providence St. Elias Specialty Hospital is now the only hospital in Alaska accredited by CARF International, the highest level of recognition available for an inpatient rehab facility. Today, I am pleased to be joined by Dr. Gregory LeBlue, who is a specialist in physical medicine and rehabilitation, also called PM&R, and he is also the Providence St. Elias Admissions and Consult Physician Leader, as well as Marcy Stalvey, a physical therapist by trade and the current manager of rehabilitation services at St. Elias. You can also be part of our conversation. If you have a question or a comment, please give us a call, toll-free, statewide. The number is 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 907-550-8433. 907-550-8433. Or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. LeBlue, it's a pleasure to have you here today. I want to give you the opportunity to tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and your training and what got you interested in this field of medicine.
Well, thank you. My name is Gregory LeBlue, and I am a physiatrist or a PM&R doc, and I'm originally from Texas and went to college and medical school in Texas. I then actually joined the Navy as a fourth-year med student, did a tour as a flight surgeon, and then I returned to residency at the University of Utah back in the early 90s. And so I've been in practice in physical medicine rehab since that time. Have practiced in Texas, where I was medical director of facility for about 12 years, and then I moved on to California, where I was a medical director again for about 6 years. And after that, went back to the South, and I've practiced in Louisiana and also Florida, and then back in California. So I've seen kind of the gamut of facilities in the lower 48. This past year, I was invited to come and visit St. Elias and consider St. Elias as a new practice opportunity. And I came here in January, and I absolutely love the people, the facility, Providence. The support that we receive here is really unlike any place I've been before.
Oh, that's great. Well, welcome to Alaska. You're almost through your first year. I mean, January's such a difficult time to move to Alaska, and especially this winter. My gosh, we had so much snow. It must have been a shock coming from California, Florida, Texas.
It was. I did do my residency at the University of Utah, and we lived in Park City at that time, so we're used to you know, some heavy snow loads. But it was definitely a change. The last 4 years, I've been practicing in Monterey, California, Monterey County, and so moving from Monterey, you know, up to Anchorage, yeah, it was a little bit of a shock in January.
I bet. Well, we're glad you're here. Marcy, I'd like to give you an opportunity as well to talk to our listeners and tell them a little bit about your background and your physical therapy world and how you got into administration as well.
Thank you. Delighted to be here. I'm Marcy Stalvey. I actually am a physical therapist. I have over 35 years of experience, and most of that has been in inpatient rehabilitation, cardiopulmonary and ICU work. And I came to Alaska following a guy. My husband took a position as an academic administrator at University of Alaska, Anchorage. And we came for a year, and we've been here 10. He's been here 11, but I've been here 10. And so I've been at St. Elias for the last 10 years, and it has been a real ride. I have practiced not just in Alaska, but I trained in California, and then I practiced in the Midwest in square states in the middle for a long time, and then moved up here. We are winter people, so snow is a good thing for us because we ski. I came to St. Elias because they had a reputation for areas of practice that I liked. We didn't have inpatient rehab at the time, but it was serving a population that is very near and dear to my heart. So it was a great opportunity, and I'm really thrilled to still be there.
Excellent. Yeah. Okay. Well, good. So we have someone one less than 1 year, and then a decade person. Mm-hmm. So a lot of different in the perspectives. Let's start by kind of going over what PM&R is, because it's a specialty that people may not really know about, or what you guys do. It's a little bit different. I had some friends go into it from medical school, and the goals of PM&R seem to be a little bit different. You know, we're as a surgeon or as a doctor, a lot of times we're searching for that cure or that fix or that whatever, but PM&R is a little bit different. The focus seems to be more about functionality and movement and gaining what you can after an injury. So I'd be interested in your perspective, Greg, about kind of what PM&R is to you.
Sure. And you hit the nail on the head about function. So PM&R, stands for physical medicine and rehabilitation, and the physicians that practice within the PM&R field are called physiatrists. But basically, the role of physiatrists is to care for people truly with disabilities. And your goal is to help people cope and manage impairments, disabilities for a better quality of life. And that's really what a lot of this comes down to, is improving quality of life, not just for necessarily the patients, but also for families, because they're a big part of this also. So, and the disabilities run the gamut. I mean, we're talking, again, spinal cord injury patients to traumatic brain injury, stroke patients, also other neurologic disorders, Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, Guillain-Barré, but also patients that may have had multiple trauma, musculoskeletal type injuries, and even some of the less traditional patients, like cardiac patients that have had a bypass that now or can't get out of bed, can't ambulate, can't dress, mm-hmm. do all the basic things. Those are the types of patients that we're more involved with. Again, with a different focus, it's not so much of the surgeon's focus of fixing the problem in the abdomen or the extremity, mm-hmm. but it's how does this patient recover from this injury, surgery, illness, how they recover and return home at a higher functional level.
Yeah, no, it's a wonderful goal for a specialty. I think it's really important, and I'm really glad that we have that in Alaska, because there's so few specialists. And until really talking with you guys in preparation for the show, I really didn't realize the scale and scope of what you guys have going on at St. Elias. And to piggyback off that, Marcy, I imagine, because of the nature of the injuries that Greg discussed, a lot of ancillary services are needed for this function, i.e. physical therapy and occupational therapy and speech therapy. So how do you guys, play together and work together in the sandbox?
Well, inpatient rehab especially is a team sport, and we work in obviously close collaboration with the physicians. Critical component of that also is rehab nursing. We have specialized nurses who have advanced credentials in rehabilitation nursing. And then we work together, physical, occupational, speech, nursing, physicians, to come up with a treatment plan that's individualized for the individual, for each person and for family. And it's, what we're trying to really do is, as Dr. LeBlue said, is, you know, restore the quality of life and help people back into participating with the things that make life worth living. And that might be, it's not just about being able to walk, but can you walk your dog? And in Alaska, can you walk outside in a variety of surfaces? And so it's giving that ability to go back. So we it's a constant interplay. We treat our patients in the same spaces with occupational, physical therapy, speech. We all work together often, and the physicians come find their patients sometimes in the oddest locations that we work. We work all over the building, outside. Sometimes they have to hunt us down.
Check the stairwells.
Sure. In the stairwells, exactly.
Yeah.
And to comment on that, I think rehabilitation and inpatient rehabilitation programs were kind of the pioneers of the whole teamwork concept, going back many years ago, decades ago, where the whole team would meet every week and discuss the patient's, you know, progress, barriers, and that included all the therapy team, that includes case management, includes the physicians. Anyone involved with that patient's care, you would sit down as a team, and you would have also other informal meetings discussing the patient's care in the plan. And we're seeing more and more of that now in the traditional models in the hospital with other specialty programs. But mm-hmm. but this is something that's at the heart of inpatient rehab.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the only thing I had of any near similarity in my training was when I was in the ICU, and that's obviously a huge team-based mm-hmm. approach too, and you have the nursing staff and you have the pharmacists because of all the medications, and in a whole team, and you're around as a team. And so I think that, you know, that multi-specialty care system is really, you know, what's catapulted our mm-hmm. our results, you know, for patients. But I want to give our call numbers again real quick here. You can reach us with questions statewide, 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 907-550-8433. Or email us line1, spelled out, at alaskapublic.org. So let's talk about an LTAC. Okay, LTAC stands for Long-Term Acute Care Facility. This is different than hospital care, and I think while there's a lot of similarities, I want to have you guys explain in your own words, you know, what an LTAC is, if someone, you know, layperson were to ask you that.
Sure. Now, at St. Elias, our first floor is the LTAC unit, and that was part of the original hospital design, was as an LTAC facility dating back to 2007. Marcy knows a lot more of this history than I do. But LTAC is still kind of, it describes itself. It's long-term acute care. So these are patients that are still fairly ill, and some are still on ventilators, requiring ventilator management. Many are still ICU level patients, but the difference is they have longer anticipated lengths of stay. So you're usually thinking, oh, this patient's going to need to be in this ICU level ventilator more than 3 weeks. And so it kind of separates out this longer term population. And LTACs originated about 25 years ago or so because of the crowding of ICUs and not having bed availability. And by mm-hmm. creating these new entities, they could still take care for these patients that did require a ventilator, did require the complex wound care, you know, complex antibiotic regimens. They could take care of them, but outside of the hospital in another facility with the appropriate resources and the appropriate physicians, including intensivists, critical care docs.
Okay. Now, that's great. Marcy, anything to add to Greg's explanation there?
Well, for a newbie, that's pretty good. LTACs serve a unique purpose in the healthcare system, and they really allow us to care for individuals who need that high level of medical care, but also are really going to benefit from more rehabilitation. So in acute care, patients who are receiving therapies might receive 30 minutes a day. The minimum expectation for people on the LTAC is an hour a day of therapies. So ramping it up a little bit, starting to mobilize them. We have a saying on the LTAC that bed rest is bad. I mean, that is the same mantra in acute care, but just try to get people moving along those lines. Mm-hmm. And the team that is involved in that is everybody from the physicians, the nurses, respiratory therapists are critical in that. The clinical dietitians, everybody supporting that population, and they have incredibly complicated needs. So it's very challenging.
Yeah. So these are really, I mean, medically complex ICU-level patients, or can be at least, and requiring maybe ventilator support, TPN or, you know, nutritional support and antibiotics, wound care. So ICU-level care, but just at a facility where it's not the hospital.
Right. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. And that's what we were built for. You know, we're set up a little bit to support that type of activity and that environment, more so than the acute care settings are.
Yeah. So Marcy, tell us a little bit about how St. Elias, how it started, when it started, because it was started for as an LTAC, and I know it's evolved, and we'll get to the evolution right here in a minute, but. Ultimately, it began, I think, when I've been there a few times. I've had some patients there. And if I remember right, when I went there, it was a few years ago now, but both floors were LTAC.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it started in 2006, 2007. And actually, the story behind it is a local physician had a family member who suffered a brain injury on prom night, unfortunately. And in order to recover, that young person had to go out of state for an extended period of time. And the family was able to go out of state with them and support them, but that triggered a desire in that family to develop something that would support Alaskans to stay in Alaska. And we believe, we've heard that the intent was to open an inpatient rehab facility, but Alaska also lacked an LTAC. And St. Elias is still the only LTAC in the state. So that's where they started. It has quite a reputation when I moved up here for working with individuals with early brain injury recovery, and that was in part of where it started. But we started as 60 beds. We've moved it around a little bit. It's now 56 beds in total, and at one time, those beds were all LTAC. So it's only two floors, but it's very busy.
Yeah, it's a beautiful building. It's a beautiful facility. So I'm really glad that that's here. I've only been over there a couple of times, but before we take a quick break, I want to, how did COVID affect? Greg, you weren't there yet, but Marcy, I was just thinking, when Greg was describing how, you know, offloading the ICU, it just brought me back a couple of years ago when the ICU at Prov was full and we were, you know, shutting down all of our elective cases. Like, did St. Elias play a role in that? Or were you guys able to take?
Very definitely.
Yeah.
And we did not open our rehab unit. We opened our rehab unit in January of 2020. It was when we took our first patient just before the pandemic hit. Mm-hmm. But during the pandemic, our ICU was full. And this was, as everybody knows, a very unique population. We were all learning as we went, but it was right in our wheelhouse. I mean, we deal with respiratory illnesses and ventilator weaning and early mobility, which was really important for these individuals. And so we were very, very busy during that time.
I bet. Well, let's go ahead and take our quick mid-break here. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. If you have a question or a comment for our guest today, call us statewide at 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752. Or in Anchorage, 907-550. 907-550-8433. 907-550-8433. After this short break, we'll continue our discussion on long-term acute care and rehabilitation with Dr. Greg LeBlue and Marcy Stalvey.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Alaska needs more quality, licensed childcare providers. If you're interested in starting a childcare business, connect with threadalaska.org for support and guidance. There are several resources to get licensed and launched in Alaska. A licensed facility opens doors and opportunities for the business owner and creates a safer, more engaged place for children. You can make a lasting difference in the lives of children and their families. This message sponsored by Thread.
Welcome back to Line 1, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. I'm joined today by Dr. Greg LeBlue, who is a physical medicine and rehabilitation specialist and the Providence St. Elias Admissions and Consult Program Physician Leader, as well as Marcy Stalvey, the Manager of Rehabilitation Services at St. Elias. If you have a question, call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752 in Anchorage, 907-550-8433, 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, so we've covered quite a bit here. I want to know if there's I had a question about critical illness recovery and kind of, well, we've talked a little bit about it through the conversation, but is there anything specific or different about critical illness recovery than, I guess, other recoveries?
Well, sure. That's a large category of patients, you know, critical illness recovery. But when we have patients like Marcy was describing on the LTAC that have been on a ventilator, have been sick or in bed for weeks at a time, a lot of them develop what we call, the medical term is critical illness myopathy. And so it's not just the effect of the illness or the surgery or the complications, but it's the effect of prolonged bed rest. And this prolonged bed rest leads to atrophy of muscles, it leads to degradation of your cardiopulmonary system. So recovery for that is mobilization. You know, mm-hmm. as soon as we can start mobilizing those patients, getting them out of bed, just sitting upright helps with pulmonary toilet, you know, and helps pulmonary function. Getting them out of bed, sitting in a chair builds endurance. We know that from studies. And then, again, start to mobilize them. You know, it may be just standing initially and standing for a few minutes in a standing frame. But then if these patients are capable of ambulating, you want to start walking. But the weakness, especially in the proximal muscles, whether it be the shoulder girdle or the pelvic girdle, is fairly profound with these patients with this critical illness myopathy. They need assistance just to stand. And so that is a major focus, again. It's out of bed, out of room, and get these patients up and moving so they can regain their strength, regain their activity tolerance, their endurance, which takes time, but mm-hmm. you have to start somewhere. And the earlier you can start, the better.
No, absolutely. So I guess, why do you think that an LTAC facility like St. Elias would be better than someone staying in the ICU at the main hospital?
Kind of what Marcy alluded to earlier. There is LTAC, there is more emphasis on therapy intervention. And so most of these patients are mobilized a little faster than they would be in the acute care side. Part of that is a staffing issue even here in acute care at Providence. They're always struggling to try to keep up with demand, and then sometimes mm-hmm. there's a few days between therapy sessions that the patient's in acute care. Well, at LTAC, it is the 1 hour a day. That's the starting place where this is not necessarily 1 hour at one time. It could be multiple disciplines. It could be PT, OT, and speech, but they will have their time during the day with the goal of let's get this patient going. Let's start mobilizing them, you know, treating any impairments may have. Speech therapists may be addressing swallow, but you want to jump on those earlier, sooner than later, because the longer someone persists with a problem, especially with swallow or with mobilization, the worse it's going to get over time.
Yeah. Marcy, anything to add on that?
Yeah, thank you. I think what I would add is that there's a component, especially for our patients who've had critical illness, of a brain fog, you know, cognition. You get really fuzzy when you're that ill. And that is mobility helps with that. And sometimes, you know, just sitting on the edge of the bed with support is more than enough, but you start to alert and pay attention to your surroundings. One of our big goals in the early days of therapy with our folks on the LTAC is to get them outside. I mean, that's what Alaskans like to do. And even if it's just to get a breath of cold air in January, that is one, it gives patients hope that, like, there is a possibility I'm going to get out of the hospital. Patients who need speech services, it's, you know, beyond just swallowing, although that's a big part of it.
Got it. So a lot more attention. Is the difference, it seems like, you know, dedicated staff, you know, in an ICU facility, it's or at the hospital, it's very much acute, or maybe there's too many things going on, but they're not getting a lot of mobilization. And so then you guys can do a little bit more of that.
Acute care, you know, it's save your life, right?
Yeah.
And then we start to rebuild that in the LTAC and take that beyond into inpatient rehab.
Yeah. So I know, so the facility itself has, for an LTAC, has how many beds?
56 total in the building. 21 of those are currently LTAC.
Okay. So 21 are LTAC. Now, I imagine you guys can't accommodate everybody throughout the state. There might be still people that go out of state, and before you guys were there, everybody went out of state. But let me ask you, like, what happens when someone has to travel out of state for an injury? And in the perspective of, like, why is it better to keep them here? So, Marcy, I'll start with you.
Oh, okay. I think there are a number of reasons. One is that it's really family is crucial to recovery. And not all family is able to travel outside of the home. We've had families who have a young person who may have had a spinal cord injury, and they have younger children. They don't want to take them out of school and disrupt their lives at the same time. They may not have the financial resources either to take all that time off from work. So this way, they can still be part of the rehabilitation process, supporting their loved one while they get that intensity of services. And you know, really, the services are comparable here. It also starts to establish the networks that are local. I think there are great services out of state. There's no denying that. But they're setting up resources out in those states and not in Alaska. So you need to build that relationship with peer mentors, clinicians, physicians, everybody that are local. And that's been a real challenge, I think, for people who come back to Alaska. They get great services outside, but taking it that next step is a big challenge.
Yeah. Dr. LeBlue?
Well, I think Marcy nailed it. It's the impact of the family and the impact of the family on a patient's recovery, the psychological impact on having your family members nearby when you're in the recovery or rehabilitation process. So that's a huge part of it. The other part is a lot of our patients require intensive family training. They undergo even sometimes days, sometimes even a week mm-hmm. or so of training to make sure they're educated on the care and to ensure a safe transition home with the family. So that's a big part of our program, and that's really is important in our patient population here, that the families are involved.
You know, imagine the prospect of getting some of these patients home is a big hurdle. And going home doesn't necessarily mean you're done with your recovery. It's a whole start to a new different phase, right?
Exactly. Inpatient rehab always referred to as more of a jump start. You know, it's the initial intensive therapy, 3-hour-a-day regimen. Again, on the inpatient rehab unit, not the LTAC, but that is really your jump start to recovery. But the large majority of the patients, when they discharge from inpatient rehab, they're not completely independent. They still have to participate in outpatient physical therapy, occupational and speech therapy programs, and even some other programs, including like with a neuropsychologist and other specialties.
Yeah, so family support, you know, in that realm is particularly important.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so having everyone on the same page, I imagine, makes a big difference for people's long-term care goals.
Absolutely, yeah. You bet.
So in the pre-call, there was something mentioned about kind of the right intervention at the right time. And so I wanted to ask you guys to expound on that a little bit more. About what, and that's on your guys' website as well, is getting not only the right intervention, but at the right time. So there's a lot that could mean, and I'll start with you, Dr. LeBlue, but what does that mean to you guys?
Well, and I'll give an example, give examples, try to make it clear. It truly means for us, it's the right time. Do we intervene as a therapy team, depending on a diagnosis, and at what point do you change level of care? And so a patient that's in the hospital that's had a stroke, you don't, and say they have a right hemiparesis, you don't want that patient just lying in bed for a week. You know, you want to start intervention day one, day two, as quick as you can. And with the intervention, you start seeing improvement. But for us at inpatient rehabilitation, we're monitoring these patients, seeing their progress, and at the appropriate time when we can predict that they would tolerate a more intensive therapy program, then we move them over to the inpatient rehabilitation level of care, which is a 3-hour-a-day program. And again, most patients are not ready for that day one or two. Mm-hmm. So timing is everything as far as intervention, whether it's stroke, brain injury, spinal cord injury, almost any disability that we can speak of, early intervention's key, but also being at the right level of care. When do you move from acute care? When do you move to LTAC or inpatient rehabilitation? When do you move from that setting to outpatient?
Yeah. Marcy, what does that mean to you, right intervention at the right time?
So we know that intensity matters. And the analogy that I share with patients and their families is that, you know, if you don't use it, you're going to lose it. So, you know, laying in bed or learning or not using your arm or your leg, your brain is going to rewire and forget how to possibly use that. So by getting the right intensity and the right treatment provided at the time helps to retrain the brain. There's a lot of evidence that can really support getting it early, often at the right intensity. And we have used a pretty intensive approach to intervention with our patients with stroke, incomplete spinal cord injury, and brain injury, where it really gets the heart rate up and running. We know that aerobic activity is neuroprotective and neurorestorative. And so we support these individuals and they really get going, out of breath, and doing things that they, their families, may not think they can do, but it makes a huge difference.
Yeah, and imagine if you're stuck going out of state for whatever reason, then that could be, you know, that just delays the potential for that right care at the right time.
It does. We've witnessed that actually in some patients that did have delay in care, delay in intervention before they were eventually transferred to the lower 48.
Okay. We're going to get into rehab now, but I want to answer an email that came through from Mark, who would like to know if there's any new treatment methods that improve the chance of a complete recovery after a stroke. So it's a broad question, but Dr. LeBlue, any thoughts for Mark?
Well, yeah, it is a very broad question, and complete recovery would make it very difficult to say, yes, there's some magic bullet out there of medication. Nothing has really changed in the last few years, at least as far as we're concerned, as far as the rehabilitation recovery from stroke. There have been some studies. They were at UCSF and Stanford when I was down there, because I was involved with some of the patients, where they were trying to use fetal tissue, and is somewhat controversial also, but implantation, trying to use progenitor cells to try to see if we couldn't re-stimulate some brain tissue in the areas of injury following a stroke, but those were kind of inconclusive, you know, nothing magic. There's no new real medication, anything that we know will just absolutely help with neuronal repair. Now, therapy-wise, over the years, there have been some therapy additions that have helped, and one is called forced use therapy, where it was a physician down in Alabama, actually, years ago, where it started just helping, like, bind a good extremity to force you to use the bad one. And they have proven with time and a lot of repetition, you can have improved neuronal recovery and motor return by using those types of therapies. You have to use it, and forced use of an extremity can absolutely improve outcome.
Interesting. Yeah. So things like stem cells and medications. Yeah. No major changes in the last few years. Obviously, early identification of a stroke is very important, because there are medications to give in the first few hours, like TPA and stuff. But Marcy, any addition to from the physical therapy world in terms of stroke treatment?
Well, you hit it on the nail. I mean, therapy is constantly evolving. There is new research all the time trying to find exactly the right prescription, but it varies a lot from patient to patient. There are a lot of different tools in our toolbox. I think, actually, I was just at a presentation recently where we were talking about the magic bullet of high intensity interval training, which is an approach that we have adopted for our patients who want to do it because it's a lot of work, and two, who cardiovascularly can handle it. And so it works for about 70% of folks. We need to figure out what works best for the other 30%.
Sure.
And there's a lot of research going on all the time about trying to find those answers.
Yeah. No. Great question. Thank you, Mark, for your question. We have a call from Todd from Anchorage. Todd, welcome to Line 1.
Thanks an awful lot. Good show. Hey, my phone sometimes blinks off, so if it does, I'm not being rude. Just so you know.
No worries. What can we answer for you?
Well, question here. You guys do an awful lot, and sometimes there may be people who are ready for discharge, no further rehab potential, but still need a lot of intensive care, including ventilator sometimes and things like that. I mean, they can't possibly be on their own and need a very high level of care, and they have no family and this kind of a thing. Often no resources, maybe, you know, they're destitute folks, maybe not. But what sort of disposition options are there in the state? And, you know, I'm real curious about that. It's great when they have families, but what about those who just do not?
Yeah, great question, Ty. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, well,
so a question is for patients that leave, and we're going to get into the rehab facility next, but when people leave the facility, they still need care. You know, where are you seeing people going to from the facility? Is it always home? Is there other places? Is there other options? So who wants to start?
Well, from my experience, more from the inpatient rehab unit, because that's what I'm associated with, we have a lot of patients that go to, if they cannot go home and they don't have the family, they go to assisted living facilities. And so that does fill a niche kind of in the Alaska and the Anchorage market. The type of patient he's kind of describing here would be much more difficult. Anyone that needed longer term ventilator management, lack of resources. I haven't been as involved with those types of patients. I know there is a facility in Idaho, and so that there's contracts with this particular facility that helps care for those patients. Marcy could probably tell you a lot more about it than I can.
Yeah, Marcy. So I mean, Providence is a huge hospital system. So I imagine there is some relationships in the community as well as maybe out of state.
Right. For some of those patients that are discharging home on a ventilator, again, that's not what Todd is describing. They need 24-hour care with that ventilator, and sometimes family can do that. Sometimes we can get paid help in a couple of home health agencies. It's a long wait to do that. There are almost no beds for ventilator patients in the community and the skilled nursing facility, and hence we have to look outside the state for those individuals. And we've had some patients actually transfer to Idaho or to other facilities closer to other family members. And that's really challenging because Alaskans don't like to leave Alaska.
That's true. So yeah, I guess the next step down would be something like assisted living or a SNF, which is skilled nursing facility.
But they don't take, they can't handle a ventilator.
Ventilators.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
And there's a shortage of skilled nursing beds here in
maybe
Alaska.
Prov will start one of those soon. Yeah. We'll see. we're going to take our second break here, and then we're going to talk a little bit more about rehab. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. If you have a question or a comment for our guest today, call us at 1-888-353-5752. Or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. After the short break, we'll continue our discussion on long-term acute care and rehabilitation with Dr. Greg LeBlue and Marcy Stalvey.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Local sponsors do right by their business and for the community by supporting public media stations. Thank you for considering adding your corporate support. You'll be in good company.
Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. I'm joined today by Dr. Greg LeBlue, who is a physical medicine and rehabilitation specialist and the Providence St. Elias Admissions and Consult Program physician leader, as well as Marcy Stalvey, the manager of rehabilitation services at St. Elias. If you have a question or a comment, call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 907-550-8433. Or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. So we have a few questions we're coming in on the phones. We're going to get to those in just a second, but I want to give you guys a real quick time to talk about the inpatient rehabilitation. So we've mentioned that's, to qualify for that, you need to do at least 3 hours of therapy. But what was the evolution to include that in the facility? And then what are the what is it, who qualifies? Dr. LeBlue, Marcy, you're the director or manager, so let's start with you.
I'm also the long-term, I'm the historian.
She's more qualified to talk about the evolution.
Probably about 7-8 years ago, there was a study, I said, that called out that Alaska was greatly underserved for inpatient rehabilitation. As a matter of fact, up until the time when we opened our unit, there were only 20 beds for the entire state, all of which were located here in Anchorage. So it's very difficult to access. And that study identified that we probably, for a population, probably needed 40, 45 beds. We were not, using all of our LTAC beds, and the regulations changed in 2019 that allowed us to think about starting an inpatient rehab unit, which really was a logical extension. I think that the magic of rehabilitation starts in the LTAC as we start to mobilize these folks and they start to wake up. But it allowed us to develop that unit. We started as 15 beds, and currently it's licensed for 35. We're hoping to be able, we're staffed for 30, and hoping to be able to use those fully by the end of the year.
Great. Yeah. Dr. LeBlue.
Sure. And just talking about the different requirements for inpatient rehabilitation, you know, we kind of talked about some of the diagnosis earlier, again, more of our classic spinal cord injury, brain injury, stroke type patients. But we need the patients to be able to engage with the therapy team. So we need patients who are now awake, alert, can understand some comprehension, at least, doesn't have to be perfect, but some comprehension following commands. And so they can engage with a therapy team, a multidisciplinary therapy team. One of the requirements for inpatient rehab is you have to have multidisciplinary program. So it can't just be physical therapy alone or occupational therapy alone. You have to have at least two therapy disciplines. It could be speech therapy and occupational therapy, but you have to have two. So that's one of the big qualifying factors. We need to be able to predict that they could tolerate up to 3 hours of therapy a day. So when you move to inpatient rehab, it's a much more intensive level of care. Now, that is not 3 hours all at one time. That can be an hour in the morning, or, you know, or an hour and a half, but it can be split up throughout the day. But with a goal of 15 hours minimum per week. There is an exception to that, though. Some patients that may be on hemodialysis, because we can take those patients also, or just more we're more critically ill with a more serious myopathy. They may progress at a little slower rate. So some of those patients we put on a 7-day program with less hours. And so there's always a few of those patients, but most are on the 3-hour rule. Another big requirement, though, to qualify for inpatient rehab is there must be a legitimate or a good chance of a discharge back to the community. And that's a big part of it, whether it be to family, whether it be to assisted living facility, mm-hmm. that's still considered a community. But that needs to be one of the goals. And that's actually a CMS or Medicare requirement that originated, I think, in 1983 with a lot of the original rules. But we do have to have that legitimate discharge plan, mm-hmm. the goal of getting back to the community.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's take a call here. It looks like Billy is calling from Fairbanks. Billy, welcome to Line 1.
Hey, how are you doing?
Doing well, Billy. What can we answer for you today?
Okay, well, this is my question. I had a brain bleed in 2019, and I got medevaced to Anchorage, and I spent a bunch of time in Providence and Alaska Regional. And when I got back to Fairbanks, you know, I went to some physical therapists there here in town. And then my left leg, I had a sprain somehow. And they told me that's what would happen. But they kept telling me about, that's muscle synergy. That's muscle. And, I just don't know how long this muscle synergy is going to go back to normal because, you know, everything I've learned about it, is just, you know, confusing. And
sure.
Well, the STEM technology, they tell me that I can't do that. It could get worse if I try to do that to help my muscle synergy.
Okay. Well, that's a terrible problem, Billy. I'm going to pose the question here to our experts, and thank you for the call. We'll have you take the answer off air if possible there. Greg, so what's synergy? What's muscle synergy?
Well, what he's describing also, maybe he's having even spasticity tone, it sounds like, more so in his weaker side. And it's really hard without actually seeing the patient
sure.
to know exactly what is going on. But you can also have where you have less control, isolated control of muscles, and you can have groups of muscles contracting at the same time. After you've had any type of what was considered upper motor neuron or brain or spinal cord type of lesion. So you may be having difficulty isolating muscles out. My true question initially, though, would be, does he have true spasticity? Does he have underlying spasticity that is interfering with his motor function? You can mask motor function with spasticity. Whether he would be a candidate for medications, you know, does he need to see a specialist? As rehab docs, we were the original people injecting Botox into muscles, not for cosmesis, but mm-hmm. in the late 80s and early 90s, using it on cerebral palsy kids. Some people are candidates for that also. I've injected many patients more in upper extremities because of some of this, you know, what he's calling the synergy or spastic muscles that need relaxing to allow other functional muscle groups to work.
Yeah, and I think obviously one of the barriers is living outside of Anchorage, and most of our resources are here in town, which makes it harder for patients that get discharged back to other locations, I imagine.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay, we have a call coming in. Brenda is calling from Deering. Brenda, welcome to Line 1.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. Excuse me. I was wondering what happens when a patient gives up and doesn't want to go on with their treatment. And I'll take your answer on the radio. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brenda. Yeah, so I'll piggyback off of Brenda's question, actually, and to make it even more interesting for you. But so there may be patients that want to give up. You've mentioned how intense it can be, you know, and having a major injury, such as a spinal cord or brain injury, can lead to a lot of depression. I mean, loss of life and function mm-hmm. as people know it. So what are the resources available? What do you guys do when patients are not progressing or don't want to progress? So tough one. Who wants to start?
Well, it is
Greg,
a tough one.
Yeah.
But to be honest, I don't see that happen very often. And Marcy's opinion on that, rarely do we have a patient that says, you know, I'm not going to do it. And most patients in the environment of inpatient rehab, it's an encouraging, nurturing environment from the nursing staff, the therapy staff, from everyone. It really is a nurturing environment. And the large majority of patients have a very good attitude, and they try. And they start, especially when they start seeing their own progress, mm-hmm. they see, wow, I am able to do this now. It just builds them up more. So that is the normal pathway. If someone truly came in and said, I'm done. I'm not doing this, and just absolutely refused. Well, then they would no longer qualify to remain on an inpatient rehab unit. We'd have to look at another discharge destination.
Sure, Marcy.
I would also just add that, you know, part of it is that we try to help the patients and their families see the incremental change. Yeah. You know, the changes day to day. There are times when we go to the physicians as therapists and nurses and say, we need a little pharmacologic help. I mean, reactive depression mm-hmm. is very normal for after a spinal cord injury or after a stroke, and medications are recommended. That's one of the first lines. But beyond that, you know, just trying to help people find, you know, see that, you know, life is different, life has changed, but life is still really worth living and performing about that. But if not, then we work really hard with this, regardless, as Dr. LeBlue mentioned, on training family, getting them to a setting where they can be successful and comfortable.
Yeah, good. Well, we just have about three more minutes here, so I'll give you guys each, a minute or so to to give us any closing thoughts. But I guess we should touch on the CARF certification. You guys obviously are very proud of that. What is CARF and what does it mean?
Well, that stands for the Commission for the Accreditation of Rehab Facilities. And it's an organizing body and a regulatory body that's actually international. So they actually accredit facilities worldwide, including the United States. And so they've basically set a standards for excellence in the rehabilitation, inpatient rehabilitation field. And there are thousands of standards. And so just recently, we did this past summer, underwent the survey for fairly intensive preparation, a few years of preparation. Marcy mm-hmm. can tell you this didn't just happen overnight. And so all that preparation, you have surveyors, they do a lot of investigation before they arrive, and then they arrive and they're here for 2 days just going over everything. I mean, there's nothing that's mm-hmm. that's not turned over. And so we did undergo that and just passed it with flying colors. There's over 2,000 standards. Out of all that, there were two recommendations saying you could improve this or improve that, and that was it. And so that was my first time CARF survey after being a medical director of other new facilities, and it was outstanding. It was absolutely outstanding. Great. Survey, and it just shows that St. Elias, the rehab program, they are doing it the right way.
Good. Marcy, any closing thoughts for our listeners?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment about the CARF accreditation. We really use that as a playbook to develop programs and to set the foundation for continuing to build out our specialty programs over the next, you know, years, so that we're better able to meet the needs of the Alaskans that, you know, that deserve that level of care. And it's a really exciting time. And I think it has really improved the level of health care available to us here, so, yeah. Especially as we age.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't recommend aging. It's frowned upon. Yeah. Dr. LeBlue, we have just a minute here left. You know, any closing thoughts for our listeners about rehab or critical illness or?
Well, like I said, I'm very happy to be here in Alaska. It's been an eye-opener for me, the whole St. Elias program, Providence program. For me, I get unwavered support like I've never had before. And there's an absolute commitment to excellence from all the people at St. Elias in the Providence system to make sure that the inpatient rehab facility, the LTAC, that we're doing things the right way. Yeah. And so it's been nothing but a great experience for me here.
Fantastic. And I imagine that extends to your wonderful staff, our physical therapists, occupational therapists, speech therapy, sure. Nurses who are dedicated to rehabilitation. Yeah, highly trained.
You bet. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, just a shout out to a couple of unsung heroes. The nurses are with the patients 21 hours of the day. We get them for three, so we call them our nurse therapists because they have to know everything. And then the other folks are the case managers who get people home.
Yeah. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thank you for our guests for being with us. Thank you to our audio engineer, Chris Hyde, and our producer, Madeline Rose. You can find more information on this and previous programs on our website at alaskapublic.org. Let us know your thoughts or suggestions by emailing us at line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. Stay healthy, Alaska.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.